We're blessed to be here. Glad to have you tonight. If you're visiting with us, we do have folks that are stopping by to be with us, and we're glad for that. It's always our joy and privilege to worship God, to study from His Word, to have you here with us tonight. It enhances that experience, actually, because we're always glad to share with others the things that we are trying to learn and do from Scripture that hopefully please God to the very best of our ability. That's where our heart and our desire is, and I'm hopeful that that's where you're thinking tonight and why you're here among us this evening. Last Sunday night, we talked at length about who elders are. And to describe who elders are, we looked at the kinds of things that Timothy and Titus were both told they should be. In other words, the character and the qualities and maybe a little bit about the skills that these particular special servants of the Lord are to have. And we spent quite a bit of time just talking about who they are, trying to identify that they are indeed not just run-of-the-mill ordinary folks sometimes, but they are people who have applied themselves spiritually to the point that they have something to offer the people of God. They have something to offer the church that it really and desperately needs. I hope that you read the first page article today on the bulletin that was published, because that is sort of an extension of the ideas that we're trying to present in these lessons. Tonight we're going to talk a little bit more about what elders do and what their work entails and what our response to that should be and how we have responsibility as well to these men who are the shepherds of the flock. We'll talk about those things, and then next week hopefully we'll talk a little bit about special servants like deacons in a congregation, and that will have taken the entire month, at least my time with you, to talk about these special functions among us that I think need to be sharpened up every once in a while, and we need to not take them for granted and think everybody knows what everybody else knows about it, and just sort of examine what Scripture has to say. As we think about this question, what do elders do, you'd be surprised at the number of people who have found themselves in a congregation where elders were appointed, and then when elders did what elders were supposed to do, they were all disturbed by that because they didn't anticipate that that's what elders would do. There have been brethren that have been in congregations where the decisions in a congregation, where the direction of a congregation has been pretty well set by a men's business meeting, and that has been one of the most expedient means, I guess, that we could probably devise to try to make a church function in some regard without an eldership. And so a lot of people think that that's what elders do. They just sort of take over from what men used to do when they got together once a month or once every 2 months or whatever it was to sort of think about the affairs of the church and the budget and all those kinds of things. And now we don't have to worry about that because we turn that over to the elders. Well, the elders do have responsibility for those things. There's no question about it. I don't think there's anything under the oversight of or under the purview of a local church that's not under the oversight of the elders. And they do some of that themselves, and they enlist the help of other people with certain skills to do certain things along those lines to make sure that those things are done well. But quite often what happens in congregations that have never had an eldership is that in those business meetings, very rarely do people have spiritual needs discussed. Very rarely do the lives of the people, unless it's some really big, egregious, public, full-blown problem, does it ever really get addressed by a men's business meeting. And so when a congregation has an eldership that begins to do what elders do, which is to shepherd the flock, which is to tend to the flock, which is to feed the flock, which is to instruct the flock, which is to guide the flock and to warn the flock and to take straying sheep and bring them back into the fold if they'll be brought back in. Sometimes people are shocked by that. They thought that maybe nobody had the right to tell them how they ought to live or what they ought to do or whether they were attending services as they should or whether they were behaving in ways that a husband ought to behave or a wife ought to behave or children ought to behave. And quite often, people in those circumstances, because they don't want somebody looking into their spiritual life, will try to find another flock to be a part of where maybe the elders don't do that. And I'll just tell you, there are a lot of congregations where elders don't do elders' work as far as God is concerned. Most people are just particularly happy that they do the things that I mentioned to begin with. They just sort of set the tone. They spend the money. They oversee who's doing this or that or whatever, but they don't really become involved with the sheep. A few years ago, a fellow wrote a book that's been quoted often, and it was really a brilliant idea, but I'm not sure I would endorse everything in the book, but the title sold me on it, and I bought it because in talking about elders, he said that elders smell like sheep. Now, I don't know that that means much to urban people, but if you have ever spent any time with livestock, you know what I mean. Forget sheep for a moment, just think about cattle. Perhaps some of you have handled cattle. Maybe a few of you have handled hogs. Maybe a few of you have had some experience, maybe with sheep. Maybe some FFA folks here or so forth have had a sheep or some such animal that they had to tend. And there's absolutely no way that you can tend cattle. There's no way you can tend sheep. There's no way you can tend any kind of livestock and do the things that need to be done to care for their health and their feeding and all the other things that have to be done without coming in and somebody saying, "Whoo, you've been to the barn, haven't you? You've been out in the pasture, haven't you? Because you've been among those people that you like." My dad was a farmer, is a farmer, I suppose, still, even though he's almost 86 years old. And I remember back in the day when they first put cabs on tractors or on combines in particular. I remember him getting a brand new combine one year that had a cab on it. And I was thrilled to death. I thought as a boy, this is great. My dad left the windows open and propped open the door on the combine, even though that was a cab with an air conditioner. Because he said, "I can't tell what that machine's doing when I'm fastened up inside that little hut." He says, "I need to be able to hear it, and I need to be able to see it, and I need to be able to smell what's going on back there." And so when he would come in the afternoons, he looked just as dirty as he did before we ever had a cab on top of that apparatus. And I learned from that there is a great deal of truth to it. You can't be a mechanic without getting grease on your hands, can you? If I go to a shop and everybody in that shop looks like they've just come out of the department store, I'm not sure that that's the shop I want to be in. If you have to tear into a rusty radiator, if you've got to drain oil out of something, if you've got to pack a wheel bearing, you're going to look like you did that by the time the day is over. And when it comes to shepherds, they're going to smell like sheep because their work is not just done in a boardroom. It's not just done in a pristine environment. It's done among people that sometimes have some dirt. It's done among people that sometimes don't smell too good spiritually. And that's going to rub off on you. You're going to have the evidence that you've been dealing with that. And that's part of what your work as an elder is. But a lot of people are thrown aback by that, because they really were not expecting that that's what elders do. I want to tell you that it should be true that people can't find a church where the elders don't elder. But all too sadly these days, it's possible to do that. It's possible to just go and meet with elders when you become a member of that congregation, and then from that point forward, you never really have much involvement with them, or you never have very much interaction with them, or you would never even think of going to them if you had a problem or if you had an issue. And if they came to you because they heard you had one, or they had observed something about your life that needed some correction, there'd be a lot of people offended. And every elder I know who's tried to do the elder's work has had that experience. He knows what that's like, to deal with someone who really didn't want to be eldered, really did not want to be shepherded. They wanted to be a member of the church where the elders just mind their business. Well, the Bible teaches us that minding elders' business involves getting involved with the sheep. There are several things that elders actually do, and one of those is to shepherd the flock, which is what Paul directed the Ephesian elders to do in Acts the 20th chapter and verse 28. We're going to read these passages in a few moments in connection with what our response should be to these things. But as you read that, I want you to recognize that the key idea in shepherding a flock is guiding it, protecting it. We could add to that feeding it, making certain it has the sustenance that it needs. 1 Peter chapter 5 in verse 3 tells us that elders are examples to the flock. And they lead by their example. There are people who believe that that's all they can do is just set an example, and I think that is an erroneous conclusion. They have more authority than just to look good and to look pretty, and people just look at them and say, well, that's what I should aspire to be. And beyond that, the elders have no ability to do anything else with them. Elders are to be examples, but there is more to their work than just setting an example. They're role models. That's the key idea. They are role models of what a mature Christian ought to be. They obviously, from Titus 1 and verse 9, have to be men who are able to teach and exhort, because in Titus 1 and verse 9, he's talking about having the capacity to refute false teaching. Having the capacity, the ability to deal with things that are doctrinally and spiritually a threat to the flock that they're watching for. So the key idea there is that they're to know the truth and they're to be able to defend the truth. And that's a pretty tall order. It's not something maybe as simple as we might initially think. Fourthly, 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 5 in the list of qualifications about elders would indicate that elders are overseers of the church of God. That is a term that needs to be thought about a little bit. The word oversee doesn't mean that they just look at it and do nothing about it. Overseeing may involve being certain that everybody's doing what he's supposed to do, and it may involve having to do some of those things yourself when others who are to do them don't do them. Everybody that's ever owned a business knows that. That just because somebody's supposed to do something doesn't mean it's supposed to, that it gets done. But it has to be done. So it may be that until somebody can be put in that role to do it, elders will have to take care of that. They oversee the church, and the key idea is that they know the way it ought to go. They set the direction for it. That is the idea of oversight. It's got somebody watching out. You would not want to see, although I think we probably will see pretty soon, cars on Houston freeways that are driverless. That is a real worry to me. I don't know about you. But you think to yourself, well, somebody surely should be watching out for that car. Somebody needs to at least be sitting behind the wheel, ready to take over at a moment's notice if there should be a collision to occur. But they assure us that's not the case, that we'll all be safer when we don't have human error involved. Well, human error is one thing. Computer error is a whole different matter altogether, isn't it? And I'm not hardly ready to give my steering wheel to a computer. And the church is in the same situation. Elders, not just are they involved in the idea of just in general setting a direction, but they have to be involved in going that way themselves and in leading the church. And then fifthly, one thing I throw in here because I didn't know where else to put it, really, is this directive that's given in James the 5th chapter in verse 14 that says if a man is sick, if you're sick, and he's not talking there about spiritually sick, he's talking about people that have physical illness. And he said, you should call for the elders of the church, and they should come and pray over you, and they would anoint you with oil. I don't know, but what that might not have something to do in our day and time with the assurance that if you have a need, they're going to see to it that need's met. Maybe there's medication you need. Maybe there's treatment that you ought to receive. Maybe they can help with getting that arranged for you if that's the case. But the idea is, I think, in that, that there should be personal contact between the church and its elders. I just think about this. When I'm sick, who do I want to see? Well, I would probably tell you there's a lot longer list of people I don't want to see. If I'm sick, there probably are people that would not be much comfort to me. People that I probably have been so aggravated by when I was well that by them showing up when I'm ill, I probably would not consider that to be very therapeutic. And so, if you have elders who show up only in a crisis, but they haven't been there all along, that can be problematic. But the idea in praying for sick folks and calling on the elders is that there should be this warmth of relationship to the point that they can make personal contact with the people that they are overseeing. It's not just some business arrangement. It's not just something that is antiseptic at all, because elders smell like sheep. They get involved with what's going on with them in that regard. Well, that's basically what we read in New Testament pages elders doing. That's what they spend their time with. That's the work that they actually pursue. But just now, I want us to think about what we are to do in response to these things and how all of this works together, because the Lord intended it for our good. He intended this for our spiritual betterment. He did not intend for churches with elders to be worse off. He intended them to be for the benefit of the flock of God. And the flock has a response that it needs to make to that. I read a number of years ago a story about sandhill cranes. And the fellow that wrote about sandhill cranes said this about them. He said they're very large birds who can fly great distances across continents. And he said there are three remarkable qualities that sandhill cranes have. First, they rotate leadership. No one bird stays out in front of the flock all the time. Secondly, they choose leaders who can handle turbulence. I suppose if you've ever watched geese, I don't know about sandhill cranes, never seen them. But I know that if you watch geese or ducks who fly in a certain formation, there is that point duck out there. There is that point goose who is the one who's going to hit anything first before the others actually experience it. So they choose leaders based on who can handle turbulence. And then, all during the time one bird is leading, the rest are all honking their encouragement. I thought that was quite interesting, that when they fly, they're not silent. They're not quiet. They got that guy out there in the front, and he's leading the way, and then they swap up every once in a while. Another guy gets out front, and what do the guys behind him do? They honk, honk, honk. And they're helping him. They're encouraging him. I think about what I've seen in the Olympics, those rowers. You ever seen that? Those guys are pretty vocal, verbal. When they're in the boat together, whatever they call that apparatus that's on the water, they talk to one another, and they're encouraging one another, and they're maybe shouting a few commands, but it's all designed so that this thing can work, and so it will go together. And so when I come to this passage in the book of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, in connection with the eldership and the church, he says, "We request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another." I think these verses contain a what and a whom and a why. And I'm going to use those particular words to track the conclusions that we're going to make from that passage of Scripture. That passage of Scripture is addressing the church and its responsibility to the point men, to the elders, to those that diligently labor among them, to those that have charge over them in the Lord, to those who are known for giving them instruction. And there are two commandments that I see in these verses. In the first place, what I read here is that he says we are to appreciate those who diligently labor among us. And then right on the heels of that, he says that we are to esteem them very highly in love because of their work. In Webster's dictionary, for the word appreciate, he tells us that that means that we value or regard something very highly. That's one of the meanings of the word appreciate. I think that's the way it's used here. That you value or regard something highly. When you say that you have a piece of property and that property has appreciated, we are saying that it has gone up or increased in value. And when we appreciate someone, that means we recognize their usefulness. We recognize their value to us personally, and then in this context, to all of us as a whole. Not just to me as an individual, but to everyone who is concerned, who has the same relationship to these men that I do. You know, you think about how you show appreciation. You think about how you teach appreciation. I think about what happens with parents sometimes who have young children. On Sunday morning, they may take a dollar out of their pocket and slip it down the pew for a child to drop in the collection plate. But if the Saturday night previous the child wanted to go to the movies and they handed him a 20, what are they teaching that child? Hadn't thought about that one, did you? What are you teaching your children when you recognize that there are some things you can get by with just a dollar for, but there are some things that are going to cost maybe 20 bucks to do, and are you not in a monetary way saying going to the movies is more valuable to you than what you put in the plate on the Lord's Day? Now there's another lesson in that altogether, but what I'm trying to illustrate by that is simply the fact that if we value these men, if we hold them in the regard that we should, and when we turn to someone meaningful in our lives and say, I appreciate you, what we are saying is that we believe you are very valuable, and maybe more so than just other things and other people who are in our lives. It should be that way for sheep in the flock of God, that they look at their shepherds and they value them highly. They say, these are people that mean more to me than maybe a lot of other people that I might know. The second command in this verse is kind of interesting because it's the word esteem. The two words appreciate and esteem are listed as synonyms in Webster's dictionary. And it does seem that the word appreciate has more to do with our attitude, and maybe the word esteem has something to do with our actions. When you appreciate someone, as we've said, you recognize their value. When you esteem them, you lift them up in your actions by what you do for them. A number of years ago, when I preached in another place, I had a little boy. He was probably about the age of Joshua Laughlin, I suppose, or somebody about that age, kindergarten, first grade. He wandered into my office one night as I was getting ready to come out to for the service, and he started looking around at all my books, and he asked me, he said, are all these books yours? And I said, yes, they are. And he noticed that over behind my desk I had a wall at that particular place of bookcases, and there were about 15 books on a shelf right behind my desk, right at my chair, that I could get without much effort at all. And he said, well, why are these books over here as opposed to over there? And I thought, well, that's pretty astute that he noticed that I had about 15 books set over here in one spot that I didn't mix in with all these others that were over there. And I said to the little fellow, I said, well, I'll tell you, these books right here behind my desk are my friends. They are the first books I turn to when I've got a question. They're the first books I consult when I need an answer. They're the first place I go when I've got a problem I'm trying to figure out. And it doesn't take you very long to realize that I could probably get rid of all the rest of those books and just have those 15. I'd probably be a lot better off. But the reason that I had them separated and differentiated from all those others is because I value them more. They mean more to me. If I had to get rid of all the other books, I could probably do that with a few tears. But I'll go kicking and screaming if you take these others away from me, because they are things I find absolutely essential to my study and to my work and to my understanding of the Scriptures. Paul says here that we are to esteem these brethren who are our shepherds highly because of their work. We're to lift up our leaders, put them in a special place on the shelves of our hearts because of their work. Seems to be a common human tendency for all of us to appreciate people who are important to us and yet fail sometimes to esteem them by letting them know about it. And until suddenly the opportunity to do that's no longer available. We don't want to do that with our elders. So let's be sure that they know that we appreciate them and that we esteem them in the way that we should. Now, the second thing that this passage, I think, will help us to see is that those whom we are to appreciate are those who have diligently labored among us. He's not talking about those that pretend to be elders and are called elders, but they're everything but elders. Yes, there are elderships that have men like that. There are churches that have tolerated that. There are churches that have appointed men to that work that never did amount to anything, never did help the church. They were dead weight from day one. And they were not diligently laboring. But Paul says if you find somebody who diligently labors among you, then they should receive your appreciation and your esteem. Now, for those of us who are not elders and who have never done the work, to understand the pressure that's involved with being a shepherd of God's people is a little stretch of the imagination sometimes. Because every elder I know would tell you that even though he thought he knew what an elder was, he didn't really learn that until he became an elder. And he found out things about that work that he never really envisioned on the outside. But once he became an elder, he saw things that he did not know previously. A man who is an elder is usually one who takes very seriously the troubles and the trials of those that are under his charge. The very nature of an elder's work does not let him leave it at the office, or maybe more appropriately, at the church building. Whether he is paid for that work or not, and we're not discussing that tonight, but elders should be paid and can be paid scripturally and ought to be supported fully in some instances. What we recognize is that he cannot simply just punch in and punch out with a time card, because he is on call literally 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You would never expect to call an elder on the phone and him say, but these are the playoffs that I've got on television here. Can't you wait another 6 hours till I'm through with this? Nobody can expect that elders would do that, because they are shepherds of the sheep, and you never know when a sheep's going to get tangled up in the barbed wire somewhere. You never know when he might be over here falling into the creek and nearly drowning because his wool's being soaked up with water and he doesn't know if he's going to make it or if he's not. So you're on call. You're ready to go. You have to be that way. And his responsibility goes far beyond just teaching. He must see that those who look to him for leadership do what he is teaching them to do. When they fail to live up to God's principles, when they choose to disobey, the very nature of his caring causes him to suffer. I don't know of a good elder anywhere who doesn't suffer over the sheep, who doesn't shed tears when they don't shed any. I've often said through the years that one of the worst things you can ever do is care more about somebody else's soul than they care for it. You can go and visit with people and they won't even turn the television off because they really don't want you there to start with. And yet you're there to talk with them about the most important thing they have, their soul. The thing that's going to make the difference in whether or not they are saved or they are lost. Paul said that apart from these external things, when he wrote the Corinthian church about his own work, he said, there is the daily pressure upon me of concern for all the churches. I imagine most elders are glad that in the wisdom of God, they are only elders over one church. Can you imagine what it would be like if you had responsibility for all of them? Or that you had the responsibility for all of them in the state? Or all of them even in the county? The elders' work is labor. It's labor. It's not just a position of honor. Paul said, if any man desires the office of an elder, he desires work. There is work to be done there. Because so much of his work must be confidential, the entirety of it is seldom seen or understood by other people. And what that means is that the burden that he operates under, he very often can't share with somebody else. And that's what gets you. That's the thing that will break your back. Not being able to share that burden with someone else except others that are in the same work with him. And so in most churches, there are elders who have labored far more diligently than anybody knows. The whole of their work is known only to God. They're patient about it. They don't boast about it. And we ought to esteem them and value them highly because of that. also as to whom we're to appreciate, he says that we're to appreciate those who labor among us. And that speaks to this idea of elders being among the people. He didn't just spend all of his time making decisions for the church behind a closed door somewhere. He is among the people, and his role is primarily with those inside the church. Jesus said in John the 10th chapter in verse 3 that a good shepherd knows the sheep by name. And when he calls them, they follow him. I've known a few men who were asked by churches to be elders, and they assumed that work, but they were not people persons. They didn't really like people. They'd be just as content to be in a cubicle somewhere all day long, dealing with no one whatsoever except themselves and maybe a screen that was in front of them. But they were not interested in people. And an elder has to be a people person and involved in the lives of those under his charge because he is among them. And yes, an elder does have charge in the Lord. Did you see that phrase in that passage? Pretty important phrase, I think. He presides over them. The eldership is both a position of authority and a position of responsibility. And when he exercises these things within the realm of God's Word, the chief shepherd supports him in what he is doing. We read in Hebrews the 13th chapter in verse 17, therefore, that he says that we're to obey our leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who will give account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief, for this would be unprofitable for you. So there is authority that's been given and recognized by God. There is responsibility that is laid upon the shoulders of these men who do this work because, as this text says, they're going to have to give an account for that. I wish I could read that and come up with some other explanation and take that load off of elders' minds. But the Hebrews writer says very plainly that what you do as an elder, in addition to what you are and who you are as a Christian, you're going to have to give an account to God for that, answering to the Lord for how you've discharged the responsibility He's given you with His sheep. Now, 1 Peter 5 says He's not to lord Himself over the flock. He leads by His Word, by His example. And the flock submits to that because He doesn't have to demand it. They do it willingly because of their respect for what He is and who He is and what He's trying to do for them. And so it's pretty important to recognize that and to understand that that's a part of what they do. Finally, as to the whom we are to esteem in our text, he also mentions here that we are to be giving our esteem to those who have instructed us. Do you see that in the last part of this commandment? Back in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and also in Titus 1, when the qualifications for these men were listed, the idea was expressed there that elders must be men who are able to teach. Now, folks, there are some people that can start with nothing and develop the ability to teach over time. You don't have to be what sometimes is referred to as a natural-born teacher. You can develop that ability, and you can hone that ability, and you can make it better than you were 5, 10 years ago. But by the same token, there are some brethren who will never develop the ability to teach. Not in the sense that an elder needs that ability. Oh, they might be able to have a conversation with someone over coffee. Not to say that that's unimportant. It is important. But an elder is going to have to be able to do more than that. I was in a congregation one time where somebody wanted to make an elder, and he had never even given an invitation on Wednesday night. He had never spoken to the church. Oh, but he's a teacher. Well, what's he taught? Well, he taught the junior high class one time. Well, let me tell you that the people he's going to have to deal with as an elder and correct are not the junior high people. That's not who he's going to have to deal with. Those that are teaching false doctrine aren't in sixth grade. Those that are threats to the church are grown men. They're not puppies, they're wolves. They're people that are going to have to be dealt with. So the skill that one must have is appreciated when you know that this is a person who can instruct me. He can teach me something that I need to know. He has an aptitude for conveying the teachings of the Master. And it takes more than just being willing to stand up in front of folks. Standing up in front of them is required, but it takes more than that. His life teaches as well. And what the people see in Him must square up with what He speaks. He teaches by word, He teaches by deed, and He does that because He knows the flock needs it so very much. Finally tonight, let me just point out to you that when we come to this passage, He tells us why we're to do all these things. He tells us that we are to appreciate these men, esteem these men, because they've labored diligently among us, they've had charge over us in the Lord, they have given us instruction. Well, why? Simply because of their work. Your doctor cannot do for you what the elders of a church can do for you. Your lawyer cannot do for you what the elders of a church can do for you. Your plumber cannot do for you what the elders of the church can do for you. Because what they're doing for you, if they're doing what they ought, is they're preparing you for eternity. They're helping you deal with what you have to deal with here and now so that you can be with the Lord forever. That's what their job is to prepare people for heaven, if they can at all. The work these men do is vital to the life of a congregation. They are the shepherds. They are the pastors of the flock. It is true that sometimes in our day, preachers or evangelists are referred to as pastors. And it still occurs that there'll be members of the church that'll introduce me to some friend. Oh, this is my pastor, they'll say. Well, a preacher can be a pastor, but all preachers are not pastors. And what we have to understand is that biblically speaking, the elders are the pastors of the church. We read, for instance, in Acts the 20th chapter in verse 28, that He said to these men at Ephesus, "Be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers to shepherd or pastor the church of God, which He purchased with His own blood." And a careful consideration of that context shows He's not talking to Timothy, who was at one time the preacher for the church at Ephesus. And He's not talking to a group of evangelists somewhere. He's talking to a group of elders, a group of men that were responsible for pastoring the church at Ephesus. In this familiar passage in 1 Peter 5, verses 1 and 2, Peter said, "Therefore I exhort the elders among you, as your fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, to shepherd the flock of God among you." The elders among them were to shepherd the flock of God among them. You see that? That's their job. That's their responsibility. And they're not to do that because they're compelled to do it, made to do it, forced to do it. But they do so voluntarily according to the will of God. They do not do it for sordid gain, but they do it with eagerness. In Ephesians 4 and verse 11, Paul wrote and said that the gifts that God gave to the church was that some were apostles and some were prophets and some were evangelists and others were pastors and teachers. My point here is simply that elders are the pastors. They're formally charged with shepherding the sheep in a local church. Besides shepherding or pastoring, the elders are to be on guard, if you noticed that passage a moment ago, or maybe right here, where he tells us that they're to be on guard for themselves. And let me just say that a man has to be both knowledgeable and alert to protect the church against whatever threats there may be out there. He has to be compassionate. He has to be courageous. He has to be steady. He has to be stable. And the nature of his work necessitates the relationship that he has over a long period of time with the church that he is superintending. Well, I've said all of these things in these lessons because periodically we need to give thought to them. And we need to think about them, as I told you last week, when we're not in the throes of trying to appoint somebody. When we can dispassionately look at what the Scriptures have to say and tuck all of that information away so that it doesn't take much of a reminder when the time comes for us to know what we're looking for and what's expected of people that do these sorts of things. We need to have greater appreciation for elders. And we need to have greater appreciation for what they do for me and for you, our souls. We must not develop the independent spirit that says, "I don't want anybody telling me what to do," or "I don't want anybody pointing out anything that I need to improve." A number of years ago, there was a visit that was made to China by the Philadelphia Orchestra. And in one of the cities where they were playing, the Philadelphia Orchestra listened to the Chinese Philharmonic Orchestra performing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony for all of these visiting musicians from America who were there. And according to reports that were done not just by American papers, but also other papers in other countries, the performance was pretty poor. In fact, they said it was so bad that they were glad Beethoven was not present. It would have just been horrific for him to listen to their Philharmonic Orchestra perform that Fifth Symphony. When they finished the first movement, the Chinese conductor realized that they were just not prepared to do this, and this was just such a mess and had been such a train wreck, that he looked over into the crowd and he saw the conductor of the Philadelphia Philharmonic. And he just reached over and handed him the baton. And the American conductor came up without ever having practiced with this group of musicians, without ever having done anything at all as far as knowing them. By the way, his name was Eugene Ormandy. And as soon as he lifted the baton, people could tell that things were going to be different this time. And you would have thought that Ormandy had been conducting the Chinese Philharmonic for years, listening to what they did under his direction as opposed to what they did under the direction of a man who wasn't really qualified to do it. And as members of the Philadelphia Orchestra listened, they knew Eugene Ormandy. They had played for him many times. They had known him for years. But they were impressed in a new way with his talent and with his genius, because what they recognized on that occasion is, we've had this man with us. He's been our conductor. But we've taken him for granted. We didn't realize that the reason we could be invited to come to a foreign country and play for them, and the reason that we were as good as we are, is because of this conductor, this director who's been with us and done the things that he's done for us. They had lost sight of the greatness of their conductor. I use that to illustrate this one important point. It is so easy to take good leadership for granted. Families experience that. You've seen families that did quite well until one key person in that family passes away and the whole family falls apart. I've seen that. I'm talking about spiritually speaking. That one person seems to have been the one that kept all of them together and kept all of them going the same direction. And without him, they floundered. They did not know what to do. But while he was alive, and while he was admonishing them, and while he was encouraging them, and while he was trying to get them to get in gear spiritually, they probably looked at the old man and said, "What an aggravation you are. Don't want to be around Pawpaw Long because he'll talk to you about your soul." But surely enough, after Pawpaw's gone, the old man's not there. The whole family begins to disintegrate. As the flock of God, we must, listen to me now, we must never take elders for granted, nor should we allow them to go without our esteem when they are diligently laboring. We haven't talked tonight about what you do with elders that don't do their work. Paul talked about that. 1 Timothy chapter 5, he talked about what happens when elders sin. When elders sin, they're to be rebuked, hopefully with a idea that they can be regained so that they can come back to doing what they're supposed to do. But in these passages we're talking about men who do their work. And we should never, ever not esteem them. We should appreciate them and remember that if we don't do this, we disobey God. And that comes on us. That comes on us. If we don't have the shepherds we need because we've not valued them as we ought. I'm thankful for Gerald and for Ray and for their service here. And there's a long list of people before them that have served in this place. That as Hebrews 13:7 says, we need to remember. And when he's talking about that in Hebrews 13:7, he's talking about people that are no longer here, but they were at one time, and what they did contributed to where you are. And he said, you remember those in the past that did this work among you. because they leave a legacy. They hand off the baton to other people that pick it up and go on with it. We don't want to disobey God, and we certainly don't want to disobey God in relation to what sheep should do for their shepherds. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, I am surely hopeful that you'll realize that Jesus wants you in the fold. He wants you in this flock. He is the good shepherd who lays down His life for the sheep. I mean, that's some shepherd to have. In John 10, when He talks about a shepherd that's willing to do that, He contrasts him with someone called a hireling. Just a guy who's working by the hour. He's only there to punch the clock and to do what he's supposed to do, and he will not do one thing more than what he is required to do, and when the bell sounds, he's out of there. No matter what's going on, he's gone because he's just going to do so much work for so much pay. Jesus said, that's no good. What we must have are shepherds who will be willing to do whatever they must do to go that extra mile. And He is that shepherd who laid down His life so that we could live, so that we could have eternal life. You hear this evening, Jesus holds forth that promise to you tonight, that you can have that if you'll obey His will. If you need to be baptized into Christ for the remission of sins, He will take you by virtue of your obedience to the gospel and make you a member of the flock. And as a result, you can have the hope of eternal life. Let us know if we can help you in that regard. While together we stand and while we sing.